श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय, गणंतरा श्रीमद् भागवतम की जय, श्री ब्रह्म स्तुति की जय, तिरुवाब महोत्सव तिथि श्रीला रामानंद राय की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रमाण हरि हरि गौर। So, good morning to all of you, Dandavat. Thank you so much for your invitation, your presence here. It's my honor and good fortune trying to render some favorable seva to such special Vaishnavas in the Harmony Collective community. So, thank you for somehow making me part of the equation. It's my good fortune, to be honest. So, Deva Mahaprabhu was generous enough to allow me to continue during the morning Bhagavad classes with some topic that I've been sharing the last months, which is connected to the Bhagavatam, which is the Bhagavatam itself, but not probably the particular canto you were studying. So, sorry for that transgression, if you will. It will be just a few days. And we will be going through the prayers of Brahmaji, Brahma Stuti, found in 14th chapter of the 10th canto. So today we will be studying verse number 11. There are 40 verses of prayers, so I don't have an idea where I will finish this series. Maybe here in 2 years or something, who knows. So I will make a brief recap before going to the verse itself, since some of you may not have been aware of the previous verse and so on. Just to put a little bit of context to the scenario in which Brahma is praying, because, if we speak about someone praying, there's why the person is praying, what the person is praying about, in which particular emotional moment that person is praying, and so on. So as you may know, it all begins, if you want to put it like that, in Agasur Lila, when Agasur is being killed by Krishna, and this is a huge event. Devas are there throwing flowers and huge commotion, universal commotion, if you will. And at one point, Brahma is like, what's going on there? No, basically, something is going on earth. Let's see what happens. And of course, he had darshan of Krishna at the very beginning of creation. At that moment, Krishna appeared to him as his guru in a relatively much more formal way, showing Gyan Mudra and acting like blessing him, giving him Chatushloki, and so on. But now in this particular situation, Brahma was finding his guru in a pretty unusual situation, not with Gyan Mudra, another mudra, and the mudra was left hand with sweet rice and yogurt in the midst of a picnic with his friends, totally informal. The fullness of informality found in this picnic that Krishna was having with his friends. So Brahma becomes a little bit like confused regarding, is he my guru? Is he the person I found at the beginning of creation? So long story short, as we know, Brahma somehow tried to test Krishna and kidnap, or thinks he kidnaps, he's kidnapping his cubs and friends, and putting them in one cave and so on. And as we know, a whole year passed and Krishna expands himself as the calves and the boys, and the boys and the calves actually remain in one particular prakash, which will be like a window in the lila. They remain there in one particular layer, if you will, of the lila. In another layer, Krishna has expanded as the friends and as the calves, so the cows and parents in Braj can taste having Krishna as their son. They wanted that, so Krishna is doing many things at the same time, if you will. And after a year, earthly year, as we know, Brahma returns, and he realizes that everything continues as normal. So Brahma is wondering, what's going on here? No. So his vimohan begins there. He has four heads, so first head starts to spin here. No. Everything goes as normal, but I kidnapped this huge amount of personalities. And he goes to the cave. Those magic expansions, if he will remain in the cave, he goes back to the Braj, and everyone is there. He goes back to the cave, everyone is there. So Brahma is thinking, maybe Krishna is taking them from a cave when I'm going to the other place, and when I'm going to the other place, he's putting them back there. So he's going as fast as he can. But in both our areas, everyone is there. Mm-hmm. So at this point, of course, second head of Rama starts to spin. Mm-hmm. Still not, he has not reached yet Bimohan. But Mohan, Bimohan will come with the forehead, sir. And as we know, eventually, all these boys and calves that were expansions of Krishna show themselves as they are, if you will. In this case, they show themselves in as big with Vishnu forms, and there are thousands of Brahmas worshipping those Vishnu forms. So Brahma is witnessing that. So that's the moment of the highest Aishwarya in the whole Bhagavatam, interestingly. No? From this one single little Krishna, unlimited Narayans coming, and unlimited Brahmas and so on. And Brahma is witnessing all that. In Vrindavan, the place that you wouldn't expect to have that degree of Aishwarya, showing actually in Braj there is much more Aishwarya than Vaikuntha than any other place. But it's buried under layers and layers of intimacy, if you will. That's the nature of Braj. For Madhurya to happen, for intimacy to happen, real Madhurya, there has to be Aishwarya in the background. If not, it's just ordinary sweetness, if you want to put it like that. So at this point, again, third head of Brahma spinning, seeing all this form of Krishna, and this is a very crucial point of the Bhagavatam, because according to Jiva Goswami, the Parivas Sutra of the Bhagavatam, or that statement around which the whole book is revolving, is Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. In the words of Srila Prabhupada, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We cannot count how many times he made that statement to make a point, which is the same point that the Bhagavatam wants him to make, which is Krishna is the fountainhead of all forms of divinity. And this point is clearly made in this particular moment of the Brahma Vimohan Lila, because Krishna is there, apparently looking for his friends and cows with some morsel of food, and unlimited Narayans are coming from him. Krishna is the source of God, if you want to put it like that. Krishna is to Bhagavan Swayam means that, basically. God is not an aspect of Krishna, as I like to say. Krishna is not an aspect of God, sorry. God is an aspect of Krishna. Krishna is God beyond God, if you will. That's a very unique Gaudiya theology. There is something more apart from above God. It's like, what? Yeah. So Brahma is witnessing this, and again, there is no section in the whole Bhagavatam that plays out this statement, Krishna is to Bhagavan Swayam, as it does this Brahma Vimohan Lila. What does it mean, Krishna is the source of God? Here you have unlimited gods, if you will, Narayans coming from this single Krishna. And eventually, as we know, all this unique Aishwaric expression, how do you say it, wraps up, like disappears, and Krishna remains just like, again, looking for his friends and calves and in full mukdata, what Vishwanath Chakravarti will call mukdata, which is somehow like naivete or something, like, where are my friends and calves? And Brahma is like, what's going on here? So at that point, the foreheads of Brahma are spinning, Bimohan officially. He reaches this stage of full bewilderment and he falls from his swan and touches the ground. It is said that the devas are not known for touching the ground. They do not touch this ground. They are on another quote-unquote level, but Brahma is putting his head on the soil of Braj, showing, I'm leaving my identity as Brahma and I want just something else. So he falls at the feet of Krishna and starts to cry and bathe his feet with his tears and starts to offer pranam to his feet, taking turns with the four heads, one head, second head, third head, and crying, he's pronouncing these prayers. So this is a little bit of context to understand which is the background that's taking Brahma to pray. And through these prayers, Brahma will basically establish our whole Gaudiya Siddhanta very nicely. And he's also making sense, because something I forget to mention is in the beginning of creation, when Brahma met Krishna, he expressed to him, I would like to relate with you in Sakya Rasa. Srila Prabhupada further confirms that in the purport to that verse, as well as Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Brahma wants Sakya. So Krishna say, okay, tatashtu, I'll give you a trailer in a few yugas. No? So he had the trailer, picnic, but he didn't pass fully the test at that moment. But nonetheless, he's feeling attracted in that direction, and now he has in front of him the corresponding deity, if you will, the corresponding form of Krishna that fully corresponds with Sakyabhava. So he's also feeling this emerging attraction and trying to make sense of his emotion through philosophy. So Brahma Stuti basically is that. It's Krishna, it's Brahma reciting so many verses establishing our Siddhanta, on which basis Bhava can emerge. In other words, if we would like to have some emotional connection with Krishna in transcendence, that has to be properly justified, if you will, in the context of Siddhanta. It's not just like, I feel that and that's all. And it contradicts so many things in our revelation. So I would say that Bhava is kind of a philosophical emotion, something like that. An emotion that has to be backed by Tattva and Siddhanta. So anyhow, we have been going through some last weeks through the first 10 verses. So we completed one quarter of our study. Today we will continue with verse number 11. But as usual, also I generally do a brief recap of the last verse that we studied, because there's always some thread and connection between each of the verses. So with your permission, I will briefly share some thoughts about that. Dev Mahaprabhu gave me blessings to not end at 9 a.m., so something like that. I will try not to transgress that exception that much. So, in verse number 10, Brahma is saying, "Therefore, O Achyuta, kindly excuse my offenses. I have taken birth in the mode of passion, and I am therefore simply ignorant, presuming myself a controller independent of you. My eyes are blinded by the thick darkness of false pride, which causes me to think of myself as the unborn creator of the universe. But please, see me as subordinate to you and therefore worthy of your compassion." It's a very nice prayer, and of course it lends itself to great degrees of identification in our particular situation. That's the charm of all the things. It's not that, okay, it's nice that Brahma can say that. Okay, it's okay for him. I have nothing to do with that. It doesn't work like that, as you may imagine. All the sections of prayers in the Bhagavatam are pretty much there for us also to inhabit those prayers ourselves, to make those prayers our own, basically. That's the success of those verses in our life. Not that we can embrace them and get to the point that, okay, I am praying in my particular situation. So basically, here Brahma is saying, you are Achyuta. He invokes that name in different verses, in different names will be invoked, of course, with some particular purpose. So you are Achyuta, infallible, and I am Chyuta, or fallible. So that's basically our sambandha. That's our connection. You are the infallible one, I am the fallible one. That's our relationship. So please, give me your mercy. Here in this verse in the Sanskrit, the word he is there, which means like certainly, and qualifies the commentator say to every single thing Brahma is saying here. Certainly, I'm an offender. Certainly, I was born in Rajas. Certainly, I'm fallible. Certainly, you are infallible. And certainly, you should show your compassion to me, for sure. So, interestingly, he's saying, I'm worthy of your compassion, which is a very interesting idea, because compassion, another way to frame that is causeless grace. So the very term causeless seems to indicate that there's nothing we can do to make us worthy. So basically that's what makes us worthy. What makes us worthy of causeless grace, that we can never do anything to deserve that, basically. And we acknowledge that sincerely. That's the price, if you will, we have to pay in terms of integrity and honesty and so on. So basically, that's what Brahma is saying here. I'm worthy of your compassion because I don't deserve it. You have to learn to think in those terms, not to develop a way of thinking that accommodates this type of apparent paradoxes. And of course, in this verse also, interestingly, says Raja Bhuva, which means I was born in Rajaguna, but some of the commentators say also this can mean that Brahma is asking Krishna, I want your causeless grace in which form? Rajabhuva will mean Raj, means also dust. So I want the dust from this place where I am now putting my head on, no? The dust of Raj, and that will be made clear in subsequent verses where Brahma famously will pray to attain. Although he has his own affinity, in his humility will say, I will like to be born in any part, in whatever species here in Braj, even as a speck of dust and so on. And we conclude the last class, also speaking in the context of Brahma's lamentation, if you will, about the concept of crying yoga, basically. You have all these types of weird yogas nowadays. So we will add to the equation crying yoga, which is not weird, actually. That's the real yoga, basically. And three levels. We spoke about three levels of tears, if you want to put it like that. You have the tears of the Bhada Jiva, the conditioned soul, which is lamenting for that which is not worthy of lamentation. As Krishna will say to Arjuna in the Gita with the word anaryam, mm-hmm. You are not behaving as someone with real values. Then we spoke about the other extreme, the tears of the Siddha, or the perfected being, which is dying in separation of Krishna, and Krishna has to come to this world to protect that. That's Krishna saying in the Gita, paritranaya sadhunam, which means what?
I'll protect the sadhus.
So the question is, why Krishna has to come and protect the sadhus? If one is a sadhu, it implies that that person, rakshishati bishvaso, fully trusts in Krishna's protection. They're fully protected. So why Krishna has to come and protect them? And of course, the deeper layer to that is that he has to come to protect them from themselves, because they are dying in separation from him. That's the type of protection he has to provide. So that's the other extreme of the equation. You know, the tears of the conditioned soul, the tears of the Siddha, desperate, dying in separation from Krishna. Mm-hmm. Even Krishna himself, and Mahaprabhu, is crying and crying. That's crying lila, basically. So in between Bada Jiva and Siddha, there we are, no? Sadaka, no? Trying to learn to cry in a proper way, trying to find a healthy expression of lamentation in our particular stages. As we were speaking yesterday with Dev Madhava, being very careful not to fall into the extreme of neurosis. Yeah. Huh? Do you know that one? And the other extreme of complacency. We don't want to fall in any size of the pendulum. At one point the pendulum will be quite extreme, to the point of being giving like 360, but eventually the pendulum will gradually find some middle point there. So we are trying to find the middle point between neurosis and complacency, if you will, and lament in a healthy way, in a balanced way. Mm-hmm. Learn to cry, to lament for that which is worthy of lamentation. Srila Prabhupada will say, do not lament for that thing which is not worthy of lamentation. So indirectly he's saying there is something that is worthy of lamentation. For saying that, Durdaiva Midrisham Mihajanina Nura. He's lamenting there, depicting the sadhaka. So basically we close with that idea, no? Trying to learn to cry, as Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say, you should cry because you are not crying. Somehow you have to get to move something inside your heart. No? And of course, we need Sri Guru and his grace to learn to cry. Basically, that's a way you can define bhajan. What's bhajan? I'm learning to cry by the hand of my well-wishers, basically. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, some thoughts regarding the previous class. Sorry for such a long introduction, but a little bit of context to this discussion. And today we will continue with verse number 11, where Brahma will somehow continue expressing further humility in this and other verses by comparing his position with that of Sri Krishna and so on. Hmm? So there is a connection that Sridhar Swami makes between the other verse and this verse, and he says that basically Krishna may reply. No? These are the famous, like, in between the lines commentaries of our acharyas, like Krishna may say to this, to Brahma, like, you are telling all this fancy stuff to me, but you are Brahma, and you have jurisdiction over the whole universe. I'm just a cowherd boy. You follow? That's Krishna's abhiman in Braj. I mean, it's not that Krishna's in Braj and thinks, actually I'm God, but I have to make the show that I'm afraid of Yashoda, whatever. No, he really is into it. I mean, he's really, that's his identity. He's totally, if you will, forgetful, if you want to put it like that, of who he is, because he's so much surrounded by the affection of the Vrajavasi. The idea of God remains somewhere there in the background, in the office of Vaikuntha or something. But Krishna here is saying, really, to Brahma, I mean, you are praying all this stuff to me, but you are Brahma. I mean, you are a big guy. I'm just a common boy, looking for my friends and cows, and having a picnic. So, and you are saying that you are my servant? How does it fit? I mean, you are Brahma and I'm a cowherd boy. How a Brahma can be the servant of an ordinary person like me? So again, still Brahma is in a form of Vimohan. Another type of Vimohan now. So Krishna will, the point is, Brahma will reply to that hypothetical question in this particular verse. So anyhow, I'll go to the verse number 11, which is in Vasanta Tilak Chanda, the particular meter. It says, Kvaham tamumahadaham kakacharakni varbhu sambeshtitanda ghata sapta vitashtikaya kvedrik vidhavi ganitanda padanucharya vatthan vathadharumabhi varasya chati mahitam. So the translation says as follows. What I am, a small creature measuring seven spans of my own hand. That's the beginning. I am enclosed in a pot-like universe surrounded by prakriti, mahatattva, ahankar, ether, air, fire, water, and earth. And what is your glory? Countless universes pass through the pores of your body like atoms through a window. So that's today's verse. Brahma is comparing his position to that of Krishna. I'm an insignificant being measuring these seven spans of my own hand. I mean, he has a pretty big hand nonetheless, but still he feels I'm nobody. I mean, I'm just confined to this particular universe with all these layers of the different tattvas or elements. And from you, unlimited of these universes emanate from each one of your pores. So here's he's connecting Krishna here as the source, as we will see, of the first Purusha, if you want, no? Mahavishnu. So he's establishing Krishna's. I mean, Krishna's even above Mahavishnu, but he's just comparing himself to Krishna as Mahavishnu, and saying, well, there's no point of comparison here. What to speak regarding who you are as Swayam Bhagavan, basically. So interestingly, here in this verse, Brahma is using the word kwa two times. Kwa means where. So somehow here, the word Brahma is using, that is, it acts as a rhetorical, you say it's rhetorical device, that Brahma is using to emphasize the vast difference between himself and Krishna. Kwa, on one side, he's saying, where I am, like who I am. And the other one is, where are you, or who are you? Basically, in comparison to the first where and the second where. So it's called the Nidarshana Alankar. Alankar means like ornament, especially used in aesthetics and poetics expressions. And Nidarshana has to do with like pointing. So who I am, where I am, and where you are. I'm trying to make that difference. Basically, the idea is that in this type of comparison, generally there is no connection between one thing and the other, or just a very extremely remote connection that can be compared. Like implying, wherever you are, I'm nowhere. Whoever you are, I have nothing to be compared with in connection to who you actually are, and so on. So this is expressed by Kavi Karnapur in his Alankarikas too. Let's go to the word by word before we explore some of the commentaries to this verse. So it begins saying kwa aham. Again, kwa means where. So kwa aham, aham means I. So kwa aham is where I am. Where am I? Brahma is saying. Then tamaha, referring to prakriti or material nature. Mahat, which refers to mahatattva. He's enumerating all these different layers. Aham means to ahamkara. Ka, either. Chara, air. Agni, fire. Ba, water. Bhu means earth. Sambeshtita, he says then. I'm surrounded by all this stuff. I'm limited to that. Andagata means a pot-like universe. So I am trapped into this particular, sometimes say egg-like universe. Sometimes the universes are described as an egg, if you will, and everything is contained, whatever is contained within it. And then Saptavitashti, which means the span, the measure of 7 spans of one hand. Sometimes that is said that, yeah, anyhow, we will explore that. Kaya means whose body, so Brahma say my body is that size. Kwa comes the second kwa now. Where are you in comparison to where I am? Idrik bidha, which means of this kind. Avigānita, countless. Anda, universes. So I'm trapped in one single universe, and from you, unlimited universes, para anu, like the atomic dust, like particles of that are emanating. Charya means moving, so they're passing, if you will. Bata adva means air holes. Roma vibarasya, of hair pores, if you want, like that, like holes of hair, literally, that's the meaning of the word. Cha also, te yor, and mahitvam, glory. So your glory is such that unlimited universes are passing through the pores of your body like specks of that just moving. And I am just one single insignificant guy trapped in one of those, something like that. So before going to the commentaries of Sridhar Swami, Sanatana Goswami, and Jiva Goswami, I'm starting my commentary on this verse or the other verses by reading one section that my Guru Maharaj has written in his forthcoming book on called Sakya Mandal. So I asked him the blessings to speak this series. I mean, I asked him his advice, what do you think? I was thinking about speaking on Brahma Stuti. I said, yeah, I wrote a commentary on the Brahma Stuti. I said, where? I read all your books, it's not there. It's in my forthcoming book, okay. So I say, so? What's the implication of that? If you want, he sent me the file so I can share that. So I'll be sharing the brief words he's saying in that connection. He says like this. Here, Brahma begins to resort to his conventional ego as the god of the secondary creation, a Brahma, referring to Krishna in terms of how he fathered him at the dawn of creation in his form as the Purusha. In so doing, Brahma makes it overwhelmingly clear that Krishna is the fountainhead of divinity, the avatari, of whom even Bhagavan Narayana is an avatar. So this is, again, very Gaudiya point. No, you won't go to a Sri Vaishnava and try to convince him of this. Narayana is an avatar of Krishna or something like that. They will think differently. And interestingly, there is place for that. I mean, they can reach Vaikuntha for eternity and stay there with that thinking. You follow? It's not that they are wrong and they will fall from Vaikuntha because of thinking Narayana is the source of Krishna. They won't fall from Vaikuntha. Not even the Sri Vaishnava. So it's not that they are wrong. There is just another perspective. It's just another perspective that is possible even in eternity. I mean, this philosophical point that Krishna is the source of Narayana is, of course, central to Gaudiya Vedanta. Narayana accepts only reverential love, whereas Krishna can accept either reverential or intimate human-like love. Were Krishna an aspect of Narayana, Narayana's avatar will be more aesthetically complete than himself. And because Krishna himself is more aesthetically robust than he is in his majestic features, Narayana, he must have an abode where fraternal love of God eternally plays itself out. There has to be a corresponding place where all the things that characterize Krishna above Narayana play out in Leela. And this is what Brahma desires. Again, he wants to become a friend of Krishna. Thus, because Krishna is the source of Narayana, there is the possibility of fraternal love of God in a realm above and beyond Narayana's majestic Vaikuntha. Because, as you know, Sakyarasa is not, if you will, the norm in Vaikuntha. Nobody is in Sakyarasa. There's no Sakyarasa in Vaikuntha. Mm-hmm. Sanatana Goswami depicted when Gopakumar arrived to Vaikuntha, he had the affinity of being a Priyanarma Saka. And he reaches there and sees Narayan and shouts like Gopal and runs to embrace. And for the first time in history, Vaikuntha became Sakuntha. Now the place without anxiety became a place with anxiety. What's going on? This newcomer wants to embrace Narayan. Stop. All gatekeepers were like jumping on Gopakumar. Please, you're going to do that. You're going to embrace God. And Gopakumar was like, okay, it seems this is not the place I will remain for eternity. So he wanted to express Sakya Bhava in Vaikuntha, but everyone was in anxiety because of that. So he realized there must be another place that corresponds with my feeling. I cannot conclude thinking I am wrong, this cannot happen, because he felt this is so real. So where is that place? And as we know, he eventually reached that place in Vrindavan. Brahma now understands this important point of tattva. Again, Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam. Out of which the bhava of fraternal love can arise. And over the next 8 verses, he speaks as if in conversation with Krishna, so as to make it clear, and in doing so, invoke Krishna's compassion. He speaks and thinks with his 4 heads what Krishna might say in response, and then speaks again as if answering Krishna. So, a brief interaction here. Krishna says, similar to what we say in the beginning, what are you saying? Krishna says to Brahma, you are God, right? Your body is the universe. Who I am to forgive you? Because remember, Brahma is crying and rolling at the ground at Krishna's feet, and Krishna's looking at him like, what's going on here? So Brahma replies to this suggestion by Krishna that Brahma is actually God. What kind of God am I? If I use my hand stretched from my pinky to my thumb as a measuring instrument, my height is only 7 such spans of my hand. I am a very small creature enclosed within a disposable clay pot-like universe, a cosmic egg, if you will, composed of the basic material elements. And what is your glorious position in comparison? Unlimited universes emanate from the pores of your body. You are Mahavishnu, Sankarsana, the first Purusha and original avatar, the compassion of Narayana personified. Therefore, you should show me compassion. So Brahma is also very intelligent. He knows how to pray and present his position in such a way that Krishna is forced to show him compassion. I mean, we have to also be pretty smart in our prayers in such a way that we really can obtain what we need. Not in a cheating way, but just like with some sensitivity. You know? How I can derive the most from this particular single prayer I'm presenting to Bhagavan. So these are some of the words from my Guru Maharaj's comment. And I'd like to share some words from some of the other commentators. Beginning with Sridhar Swami, ancient venerated commentator that Mahaprabhu himself considered as great, great authority, coming from his Bhavartha Deepika, or his commentary to the Bhagavatam. So Sridhar Swami, in his commentary, I won't read every single part of every commentary, don't be afraid, but I just will highlight the main points, and many of the commentaries repeat what other commentators say. Sridhar Swami mostly repeats the verse in itself in his commentary, and he concludes paraphrasing Brahma saying, therefore, on account of being utterly insignificant, I deserve that you show me compassion. So again, he's using these apparently contradictory terms. I deserve your causeless grace. Why? Because I'm so insignificant. That's the logic of grace again. I deserve it because I do not deserve it. But I need it. And that's how we should think, as the saying goes. I don't know if you have the same saying in English, which basically says, help me when I deserve it the less, because that moment is when I will need it the most. You have it?
Yeah.
Okay. We are not that far culturally. So help me when I deserve it the less, that's when I need it the most. That's the way. That's how costless grace works. I mean, we have to really entry into the implications of causeless mercy. Because if not, we very subtly may be mixing some deserving elements, and that stops being causeless grace, basically. So that's a very intense situation. You know? Like, if you're asking for causeless grace, means you're asking for something that is so, how to say it, so valuable, that no matter what you do, you will never deserve it. It's not only that I do not deserve it today, but eventually I will acquire some credit and I will actually deserve it at some point. That doesn't happen like that. The closer you get to causeless grace, the more you realize the nature of that grace, and the more you realize, no matter what I do for eternity, I will never deserve that. But nonetheless, I need it. But I will never deserve it. But that requires a huge degree of humility. Because imagine, you are expecting to receive something, and not just a little bit of that, but be fully covered by that, and you will never deserve that. So you are expected to coexist for eternity with something that no matter what you do, you will never deserve. You have to be humble to deal with that. Because for the ego is, I want to deserve something. It's too much for me to only deal with stuff that I will never deserve. For the ego, that's like poison, basically. And that's why many times we still want to deserve something. So, okay, you're invited to go back to the realm of justice, karma. You do something, you deserve something, here you are. But you end up being a loser in that realm. So there is a price. My point is, there is a price to pay for causeless mercy. Because sometimes that we say costless doesn't mean priceless. You follow? It's not that I want costless mercy, I don't have to do anything. I'm just like, mercy, 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 here, here, here. No, no. You have to have such a degree of humility that if you play out the implications, it's way more harder to receive costless mercy than to receive justice. To deal with justice, you can remain as you are, full of ego and all that. Justice will come out of its own accord, no problem. Costless mercy will come out of its own accord, but in order for us to properly host that and receive that and honor that, we have to be humble. Because if not, it will be too much to realize, I do not deserve it, I will never deserve it. You follow my point? So, costless grace doesn't mean priceless grace. That we do not deserve something doesn't mean that we don't have to do anything for that thing that is coming that we do not deserve. Anyhow, let's continue with Sanatan Goswami's Brihad Vaishnava Toshani. He's paraphrasing Brahma in his purport. He says, alas, since I'm extremely insignificant, I do not deserve to make you forgive my offense. You are supremely great. So, here's a different nuance. Brahma is saying, I do not deserve to be forgiven. So actually, there are different ways of expressing humility. At one point, you may say, please, Bhagavan, forgive me. At some point, you'll say, actually, I don't deserve to be forgiven. And eventually say, but I need your grace. Because at the end of the day, you won't tell Krishna, actually, I don't deserve to be forgiven, so don't forgive me. It doesn't work like that. But you can make the point that you are realizing, actually, I do not deserve to be forgiven, but I need to be forgiven, so please forgive me. So actually, there is no contradiction here. They're just different degrees of Brahma's expressing his humility and realizing the degree of his mistake, if you will. He continues paraphrasing Brahma, saying, describing the universe as a... he's not paraphrasing, he's just mentioning Sanatan Goswami. Brahma's describing the universe as a clay pot is for the sake of expressing an utter insignificance with regard to Bhagavan's glory, as well as to confirm that the universe is destroyed after a short period of time. Because remember, Krishna told him, but you are the master of the universe. He said, well, in one sense, this universe is insignificant. So I'm the master of something insignificant. If you want to put it like that, I'm still insignificant. That's the point. I mean, not insignificant in a way that we are world deniers and condemning, this world is bad, and in that sense, but just in the context of his humility. Because Brahma basically saying, a few minutes ago, I was thinking I was a great personality, and I was thinking I was the master of the universe, but your grace, and I'm realizing which is my actual position. Remember, here Brahma is having considerable epiphany. I mean, a few minutes ago he was thinking Krishna's an imposter, no, and I have to kidnap all these guys and kill it. And now he's realizing he's the source of even Narayan. Try to imagine if you have an epiphany like that in 5 minutes. No? Thinking this guy's an imposter, and then you realize he's the source of God, of Narayan. So Brahma is still in shock. No, well, of course, his prayers are quite eloquent, but still he's like, you know, awakening to the dimension of the epiphany he's having. Let's continue with Srila Jiva Goswami's commentaries. I say commentaries because he says he quotes this verse in his Bhagavad Sandarbha in Anuchit 32. He will quote many verses from the Brahma Sutta, interestingly. He's making his point in this section of the Bhagavad Sandarbha that Krishna's body is unlimited, which is an important point that we may take for granted from day one. Oh, Krishna has an unlimited body, but try to play out the implications of that. And generally, our experience is that bodies are not unlimited. Actually, bodies are delimiting, no, the particular reach. But in Krishna, he has a body, he has a form, but it's not a form that is constricting, but facilitating, if you will. That's an interesting idea too. In one sense, that idea is more difficult to grasp than Brahman without a form. Because you can say, Brahman, the unlimited, no form. Okay, yeah, here the limited has form, so the unlimited must have no form. But on top of that, you have a Prakriti. It seems it's limited, but it's an unlimited form. So it's like, okay. We have some experience of that in this world. For example, I don't know, if you're an artist, and you like to, I mean, you have some art inside of you, if you will, that wants to be expressed. You need some form to facilitate the expression of that art. You need canvas, you need brush, you need external elements, which are forms, to facilitate the expression of that. So not necessarily form is something that is limiting, but it can also facilitate. So in this case, we can speak about eternal form of Bhagavan. So Jiva Goswami is, again, mentioning this idea Krishna's form is unlimited, and he will quote Brahma's experience from this section to bolster his argument. Like implying, Brahma is agreeing with my conclusions, Jiva Goswami will be saying. So he's trying to, in this Bhagavad Sandarbha section, he's trying to establish God has a personal form, which again, we take for granted, but if we travel in time and certain moments in India and history, the prevalent current was there's no form at the end of the day. So it's important to make some historic grasping to understand why our teachers were emphasizing all the things so much. So Jiva Goswami is paraphrasing Brahma and saying, Brahma is saying, through Jiva Goswami, you pervade all the material worlds and all the spiritual worlds. Compared to you, even just as the master of all material worlds, I have many holes. One other word of the word hole here. And one idea is, universes are coming from your pores, from your holes. But here he's saying, compared to you, I am full of holes. So another word, as you know, the Sanskrit can lend itself in so many ways. So in order to say this, Jiva Goswami mentions here, Brahma is praising Krishna first as the first Purusha, again, Mahavishnu, Karanada Kasai Vishnu, who is a particular Sankarshan and the creator of Mahatattva. Now, to say that before Mahavishnu is glancing at Maya Shakti, he's known as Sankarshan. This is mentioned in Brahma Samhita. And Jiva Goswami makes a nice, interesting commentary regarding the seven-span measuring. Say that the body measures 7 spans of the hand, technically it's called vitasti, the distance between the extended thumb on the little finger. This is a thumb, right? So you can try yourself late, no? You can multiply this by 7 and see if it fits with your size, if you will. So the point that Brahma is making is, if you have that seven spans, that indicates lowly manhood, according to the Samudrika Shastra, which is like, how do you say in English? Physiognomy? Yeah, okay. The science of studying bodily symptoms and size of the different limbs and so on. In other words, your inner reality becomes reflected in your outer body. And we know in Shastra there is this description of the Mahapurush, or a great personality, which has certain specific symptoms. Now, eyes like lotus and long hands and these and that. There are like 20-something, I don't remember, Chaitanya Charitamrita. This described 1342, I think. And there are different traditions which say this, the same thing. My Guru Maharaj was mentioning recently that, for example, in Buddhism, they will say that for every good limb in your body, if you want to put it like that, no, that implies 100 good acts you perform in the past, and backed by 100 good thoughts. So that's it, that reflects in the form of a particular perfect expression of a bodily limb. Some background is there. So Brahma is comparing himself to Krishna in that connection. So it is said that the body of a great personality will be 9 instead of 7 of these. So saying, I'm not a great personality, actually. Brahma thus implies, each hair pore is one extremely minute place, yet in them all the universes reside. The conclusion is then, therefore, naturally, you should show compassion. You should transgress justice and give me what I do not deserve, basically, Brahma is asking. Let's conclude with Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's words in his Sarartha Darshini. I don't know if we have some few minutes, if someone has a question or anything else, please. So one paraphrasing of Brahma, very interesting, that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur does. He has always very interesting way of presenting things in his commentary. Though you create the universe, Brahma is saying to Krishna, though you create the universe, not me, you are not proud. Implying, I actually am not creating, I'm a secondary creator, Bisarga, but I'm proud. And you are creating, and you are not proud. In comparison with that, what powers do I have to be proud of? All the planets from Patala to Satyalok are situated within that form of yours. In that expanse, where am I, measuring only 7 spans of my own hand? Countless universes pass through the pores of your skin, just as particles of dust pass through the holes of a window screen. Who can possibly measure that greatness? And he concludes saying, compared to you, neither my godly might nor my prowess should be taken to be significant, like the leap of a grasshopper compared to Garuda's ability to fly. So he somehow or other he's trying to make all these comparisons. In previous verses he say, you are like a big fire and I'm just like a spark. Here I'm like a grasshopper, you are Garuda. And so on. I'm trying to make the point over and over again. So in this verse again, Brahma mostly praises Krishna in connection to the first Purush, to Mahavishnu. And the next verse he will praise Krishna in connection to the second Purush, and so on. And he will eventually praise Krishna not only as the source of all Purushas, but even as the source of Narayan himself. Again, as we mentioned, confirming this statement of Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam, which is arguably the highest theological point in the whole Bhagavad. So Brahma's tutti is really crucial because of that. So anyhow, some thoughts we want to share today. If we have some few minutes, we can entertain. If you have any questions or comments, thoughts you would like to share, then Madhav Guru.
Thank you, Maharaj. I've long wondered about Lord Brahma's recollection of these pastimes after this day of Brahma, because Krishna comes, we hear, once in every day of Lord Brahma. So does Lord Brahma have any memory of these pastimes that he's witnessing and also engaging in some degree the next time around, or is Yogamaya covering that over?
You are asking if after all this, for example, situations,
the whenever next,
Krishna comes
around.
The next day comes around.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Well, in connection to, of course, that's that I know of. That's not like directly addressed here and there. Like, yeah, Brahma actually.
I haven't heard.
Yeah. What we know, of course, is interestingly, and that's also a way you have. I was thinking about that because we have heard that this Brahma eventually attains perfection in coming in Gaur Leela's Haridas Thakur.
Yes.
But also we could think, okay, if Rama came as Haridas Thakur and attained perfection, I mean, the whole life of Brahma is not over yet. Mm-hmm. So if he attained perfection as Haridas Thakur, where is Brahma now? Where is that Brahma who attained perfection, if you will? Do you follow my point?
Yes.
So, those are interesting considerations. To be honest, I don't know. I mean, I don't know in the sense of I've never heard that, okay, Brahma is recalling. Because again, follow this idea, Brahma is here in Krishna's descent 5,000 years ago. So still we are in the same day of Brahma. When Krishna comes as Mahaprabhu, that's the same day of Brahma. It's just a few thousand years ago for Brahma's like blinking. And he comes as Haridas Thakur, and we hear, okay, he attained perfection as Haridas Thakur. So what to speak of in the further of his, in the other days, will he remember that? Well, according to us, he attained perfection as Haridas Thakur. Mm. So it doesn't mean that he's leaving his post and because he attained perfection and entered Golok in Sakya Rasa, and we have to get some other Brahma in the midst of Brahma's life, if you will. You follow my point? Or we could say he attained perfection, but somehow he remained as Brahma to conclude his...
maintains his services.
Exactly. No? And one that's over, he's going there. No? Which I may lean more towards that idea, of course, and not so much like, okay, let's get some emergency Brahma here. Although we hear that sometimes it is said that Bhagavan himself plays the role of Brahma when there's, but the idea generally is when there's nobody qualified to do that. In this case, we could think in another direction, Brahma became so much qualified that Bhagavan needs to come and feel that because Brahma now went somewhere else. So some of those may be some of the ways to think about that. But yeah, that I know it has not been like officially dealt with specifically somewhere. But someone is there as Brahma, for sure.
Okay.
Although it may seem that the whole universe is like falling apart, there is some Brahma there. Or maybe that's why the universe is falling
wrong.
Apart. All this is because Brahma attained Sakya Rasa and there's nobody in that post now. Yeah. So, of course, that's a long conversation. Let's speak about humility. I mean, be ready. I mean, fasten your seatbelt, and we have eternity for doing that. But, of course, yes, humility is not something that you can just, like, invoke mechanically. Like, okay, let's be humble. Now, bottom H, humility. Okay. I mean, you can make a show of that, and you can just program yourself of, okay, in that situation, I'm supposed to be humble. But if you think even I'm supposed to be humble, how much humility is there? I mean, humility should be something really like a natural overflow that you will go through by just realizing who you are and what's the nature of the gift that is coming to you. I remember once someone, I was with my Guru Maharaj, and someone asked him how to be humble. No, something like that. And he replied interestingly, that's not so hard, he said. And the devotee was like in shock. No, it was hard for him at least. He said, it's not so difficult, because actually, if you understand that bhakti is a gift, and I don't want to send any subliminal publicity of my book or anything by saying that. But if you understand that bhakti is a gift, and you do not deserve the gift, I mean, you cannot be but humble. Yeah. If you remain aware of the nature of the gift and how you don't deserve that, I mean, that all, at every single moment should be like establishing, grounding you in further humility, because that's the fact that's going on. It's not that you have to like to create some artificial effort to be humble. Ideally, humility should be the most organic and natural reaction to the nature of reality. If you really, and of course, as you mentioned, there's a connection with that with sambandha, because sambandha basically means conceptual orientation about the nature of reality. Who is who? What is what? If you receive that properly, humility has to come like the most natural outcome. It's not like I have to force being humble. I mean, if you feel that humility is forced, that's mainly showing your lack of sambandha jnana. How little aware you are of actually who you are, who is Krishna, what's the nature of the gift of bhakti in your life. And that's why it's so important to hear about those things over and over again, because that's grounding us more and more in the type of humility we must have to succeed in the journey, basically. Because if you are not humble, as I mentioned, it won't work. I mean, you won't be able to tolerate costless grace. Sorry to imagine. You won't be able to tolerate mercy. It will be too much if you are not humble. Because the implications of mercy, again, is I will never be able to do something to deserve this. And you should be celebrating that, actually. So humility is what really allows us to celebrate the nature of the gift. But if there is no humility, that same thing that you can celebrate becomes a torture and it's too much for you. So that's why humility is such a crucial thing, and why Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami will say when explaining the third verse of Shikshastaka, if you want to attain prem, you have to embrace this verse and chant with that spirit, which of course speaks about humility among other things. Without this, there is no prem. Without humility, there is no prem. So yeah, I would say that, no? The more we are honest and open and we basically expose ourselves to proper sambandha jnana, humility has to be the natural byproduct of that, basically. If that's not happening, we should like recalibrate. You know, how do I see myself? How do I see Krishna? How do I see bhakti? How do I understand all this stuff? Maybe I'm starting to think in terms of, I deserve this? I don't know. This can happen. I mean, even without you noticing, this type of deviations can filter into our thinking, and I deserve whatever. So it's important to remain in this idea of whatever is coming from bhakti in all its different forms is nothing else but grace. Prasad, I mean, the very word is making that point of prasad. And prasad is not only the thing that you have in lunch and breakfast, it's everything you have from morning to night. That's all prasad. This prasad, all of your prasad. I mean, if you really play out the implications of the gift, it's like, my gosh, no? Where prasad and is not. Basically, no? So that's humbling. So the art of the sadhaka, I would say, is to behave in such a way that you are always in a humbling situation. And again, I know it's not easy to deal with, because too much humility, we are not maybe yet able to deal with that degree of humility. But we see the expressions of our superiors, if you will, and I mean, they are coexisting with humility on degrees that we cannot even fathom today. they're happy there. It's not that they are suffering, I have to be so humble. No, it's so painful. I would like to be a little bit less humble. I mean, it doesn't happen like that. No. Give me a break of humility or something. Yeah. There was some, yeah, whatever. There were many raised hands. That's the problem when you are in the front. Many others are raising the hand before you. And tell them.
Oh, myself. Yeah. I wanted to jump off that march because you're pointing humility is kind of like recognizing the positive and feeling humbled by the opportunity to engage with the positive. Mm-hmm. And unavoidably the implications of your book and the information coming out from the acharyas, it seems that our existence itself is a gift, and even our existence in the material energy as it begins is a gift. Mm-hmm. And yet, the tone of our presence in the material energy is, the presentation is often that we should feel ashamed. And so then our humility comes from a kind of shame, rather than that sense of appreciation, positive, like any existence is itself a gift. Mm. And I have opportunity for more existence in deeper realms, more intimate realms. Can you say something about that dynamic? How we, because the shameful angle is definitely there in the Shastra as well.
Well, as you know, Shastra speaks to many degrees to different types of people, and as we know, not everyone is in the same situation, and therefore not everyone needs the same treatment, if you will. So you will find statements like those, as you mentioned, where there is more. I mean, Shastra is not promoting a guilt trip, just in case. Even when we find those statements that it seems like they are mostly playing with fear, with this type of values, instead of just see everything at mercy and appreciate everything in positive terms. I mean, not everyone is ready to ride that boat, if you will. Although that's the ideal way of appreciating everything. I mean, that perspective is there. But in some cases, Krishna himself is saying in the Gita, artha jignasur artha tijnani tabara tarasubha. Some people approach me because they are suffering, because they are fearful, because they are... And he's saying, well, at least they are approaching me. Maybe if that's not happening, they won't approach me. So let them indulge in that, if you will, for a minute with me. Eventually, we will polish the nature of their approach, if you will. So I wouldn't see that as necessarily a problem. I mean, the problem is when that approach needs to be updated, if you will, and that's not happening. Like when you, I don't know, it's not wrong to be a Kanishtha Adhikari, as I like to say. That's not a crime. No, a Kanishtha Adhikari means you have Adhikar for Bhakti. That's glorious, in one sense. The problem is when you are expected to upgrade yourself from Kanishtha to Madhyam, but you insist in remaining a Kanishtha. That's a problem. You follow my point. No? And to be a Kanishtha means you have a set of viewpoints and faith and ways of conceiving things that may not be the most developed ones and broad and deep ones, but it's what you can at that moment, and it's glorious in its own way, and we should learn to appreciate that. But when you are expected to leave the pacifier and become an adult or whatever, and you still have your pacifier in your pocket now here, no? Hopefully you don't. I mean, we have so many ways of having pacifier, no? But social media is a pacifier in itself, no? Some peace. So that's another topic. We will speak with that on the rest of them. The problem is there. So my point is again the same. No? For some people, it's too much to speak in such positive terms, if you will. They need some language that, okay, you have Maya here, you have Krishna here, more dichotomy, black and white thinking. I mean, Kanishtha Adhikari thinks mostly in terms of black and white. And even if you want to establish and develop a very broad, big group, for example, spiritually speaking, you have to speak in black and white terms. Mm. If you become too nuanced, that's overwhelming for the majority. The majority of people are not there for the grace in between. They need, okay, tell me what is correct, what is not correct. Okay, this is like this is like that. Bus. Okay, great. I have all the answers. I know what to do, what not to do. I'm Krishna conscious now. Something like that. Well, yes, but in time you will realize that in between black and white there are 256 varieties of gray. You're expected to navigate and inhabit those. And that may be overwhelming because things can be in one way or also in another way and also in another way, and all of them are right. It's like, whoa. So I will say in times that will happen, and when you reach that place by your sincerity and the grace of bhakti, then you will read Shastra and those statements, for example, understanding the particular context, and maybe those won't be the ones that will resonate that much with you as the ones that will promote a more, if you will, user-friendly approach to reality in itself. Because, yeah, maybe for someone who is coming, I don't know, from a totally exploitative situation in material world and doing so, I say, Maya Shakti is mercy of Krishna also. Maybe for that person it's like, no. I cannot swallow them.
Digest that. Right?
Yeah. Show me that there is something better than this. So I can leave this place and go to that real place. So I need that now. Maybe they won't say it like that, but they need that at that moment.
We should be able to see that.
Yeah. I think that's also part of our... If you have the other higher vision, if you really have that vision, you should be seeing how others do not have that vision when they do not. And you should be compassionate enough to go to wherever they are and speak in the terms they need to hear. And of course that can be, again, complicated because our acharya have done so and they have spoken in certain level to certain people. And you may think that's all they had to say about that in that particular relay topic. And no, probably they were just exhibiting their compassion and trying to reach out to the level of the other person's understanding. So, you have some question in the back? Sorry.
No, it's just like, because I was higher, I was pointing out to the people that raised their hands.
Oh, okay.
Like this one.
Okay, thanks for the... Sir. Do you have a question? Yeah.
Thank you. I just really wanted to appreciate the point of you're making about not deserving, I deserve your cause's mercy because I don't deserve it.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And that, and she actually, that became like a foundational, like, part of the Catholic Church is like this principle of like your qualifications, the littler you are, But I just thought it was interesting because there's like a flip side of it that she also, like, there's stories that like at the end of her life people were clipping her fingernails, and she's like, you should save those, for relics, like that she, which seems like excessive pride, but because she had this sense that, like, I'm so small, I'm so nothing, but that, therefore, God is certainly going to, take me and see me. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking maybe, I don't know, but, you could talk about how that kind of plays out, that it seems like there's a certain sense of arrogance also, even, like, with the gopas and the gopis that, they have such excessive humility, but there's also a spiritual pride that comes that because I'm so insignificant, but still Krishna is seeing me.
Okay. Willing to renounce your breakfast today? Yeah, I don't know if to call that spiritual pride. I mean, you can use words, and of course, everyone, but I will say some deep sense of confidence, if you will, about the nature of Krishna. And the nature of Krishna's mercy and how that works, how the psychology of mercy works, as you were saying. And that's the psychology of Nityananda Prabhu, no? Like, oh, they are disqualified, that's qualifying them. That's their qualification. They are totally unqualified. Let me go there, no? Basically like that. So, So there are different ways of expressing humility also, no? I mean, we may think in the beginning, okay, humility means I'm nobody, I cannot do anything, and like this, and there are some other degrees of humility where you have to acknowledge all the miracles that are happening through you without putting your name under that, no? Like trying to put the signature, it's me. Because you have very clearly, it's not me. But I cannot deny this. And there's this famous story of Ramanujacharya's disciple, that he was pretty expert in any single field of action, anything. He cooked nicely, chant nicely, preached nicely, draw nicely, wrote nicely, everything you can possibly imagine. He put he has a nice sikha, everything in place. And once his god siblings ask him, you do this so nicely. He say, yes. And you chant so nicely. Oh, yes. No, and you did, yes. So they were like, oh, he's becoming proud. Mm-hmm. So they went to Ramanujacharya and say, just we are concerned about our god brother that he may be indulging in this false sense of position, because every time we glorify whatever he's doing, he's acknowledging, he's saying yes. So Ramanujacharya is calling him, and when he comes, say, so your god siblings are concerned about you, and they say that you say yes to all the things. I say yes, because if I can do all the things so nicely, it's only because of your grace in me. So if I say no, I'm denying the power and the reach of your mercy in someone as insignificant as I am. So again, externally it seemed you're being proud, but actually that's a higher degree of humility. And there's so many ways in which humility will play out according to different stages. Again, and maybe you... In some other stage, I mean, you hear Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Charanagati or some expressions, Amar Jivan, and he's saying, I'm full of lust, for example. So how you figure that out? Because one option is he's actually full of lust, which is not the recommended equation. Another is like, actually, he knows he has no lust, but he's writing that for us. I don't think that's the case also, because you really feel, he really feels what he's saying. It's not just, okay, let's write a song so my condition followers will kind of identify with that. No? I'm full of lust and I do anything. No. So how to explain? I mean, because he's feeling that, but he doesn't have that. How does it play out? No? So I remember once this idea came to me, like, in connection to what Srila Siddhar Maharaj says, that when you approach the infinite, you will realize there's no limit to make for making progress, which is an overwhelming darshan. Try to imagine. You are entering into a realm where there's no limit for progress. It's not that you can say, okay, now I'm progressing. Because there's so much progress that you can do that you will never feel, I'm there, I attained that. That's the infinite. That's the nature of dealing with something which is infinite. You cannot say, I catch it, I grasp it, unattain it. And that's what keeps you humble for eternity. So the idea was, okay, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, of course, he's who he is, Kamala Manjari and so on. So he's there. He has no lust. He's full of prem. But the nature of prem is ever expanding, ever always updating itself, if you will. So there's so much more prem, if you will, to attain without limit, that the subjective experience will be, I have so much little prem in comparison that I'm full of lust. Subjectively speaking, I feel I'm full of lust, although you have prem. And it's difficult to grasp all the things unless you are there. No? That's why Srila Prabhupada sometimes with this question were presented, he will say, why don't you go there and find it for yourself? No? Like implying, we can speak, we can think about it, but at the end of the day, you have to go there. And there, everything will make full sense. So that's what takes, personalities like the ones you mentioned to, at the same time, be totally humble. No? Like Sri Radha, for example, she's the highest example of humility in so many ways we can quote. But also she's the one that will, how do you say in English, like, assert herself, in a situation where nobody else can please Krishna as only she can. But again, that self-asserting is only the spirit of giving pleasure to Krishna. So that's the backbone of humility. It's not, okay, I am special here. Nobody else can do that. Okay, I'm for it, basically, no? So I would say that, no? Or like the example of the Christian saint you mentioned. Yeah, someone can apparently express himself or herself in a proud way, but if their awareness is whatever, my nails or whatever is coming in, is in me, it's all grace. Now, at one point you will realize whatever is part of me is just Bhagavan's grace. So, I don't know, someone may, if you really have the insight, there's no problem, if you will. No? Like, I don't know. I won't do that because I'm not in that position, but let's say someone, you know, has a garland and really feels, actually, this is not my garland. This is not about me. This is Bhagavan's grace and me. And eventually, someone may give that garland to someone else. Say, oh, you're proud. You're thinking you're sharing your remnants with other people and stuff. But we don't know. We don't know what's the internal conception of that person. And that's what we should always go first. Now, we should always first consider from which place that person is doing what he's doing internally. Externally, who knows? As Srila Prabhupada said, you may be entering the altar and climbing on the altar and you say, oh, you do you think you want, you are Gornitai or you are maybe Advaita or Gadadhar and you are just adding to the equation and two more are remaining for the Panchatattva to be here. Come, guys. No. You may be climbing the altar to clean the altar because your guru gave you the service. So you are doing that in humility, although externally it seems you think yourself the deity. You are the deity. No, no. I'm following my Gurudev. So it's important, again, not to judge a person or a situation by the externals, which is not as easier said than done, I can tell you. So easy, we can just be drawn by form, external presentation of the whole thing. Anyhow, I don't know. Yeah.
Maharaj, I was wondering that when did Brahma spoke Brahma Samhita? Was it right after this?
Again, sorry, Brahma?
Yeah, when did Brahma spoke Brahma Samhita?
Uh-huh.
And then also, Lord Indra is always there. You know, he's a demigod. And he must have seen this pastime happening. Or was he not privy to this pastime?
Which pastime, sorry?
This Brahma Vimohan Leela.
Uh-huh.
Because he later, you know, thinks the same thing, that Krishna is not the god. He's an imposter. And he tries to do the Govardhan Leela.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, do you have anything on both the questions?
Yeah, the Brahma Samhita is, of course, mostly connected to the beginning of the creation cycle, like something, if you want to put it chronologically, happened before the Brahma Vimohan Leela. In which, of course, Brahma is receiving particular darshan and praying to Bhagavan and so on. So that on one side. And on the second side, regarding the question of Indra witnessing the Brahma Vimohan Leela, and after that, because that comes after in the Bhagavatam, doing what he did in the Govardhan Leela. Well, the main point of the history is that, of course, Indra... we could say Indra was aware of that. Because, again, who is Indra? No, it's important to understand. Of course, the Bhagavatam, he's, for us, the guru of what we don't have to do, basically, generally. He's being instrumentalized in that direction. So also we need to understand how Shastra sometimes is, like, if you will, using certain characters to make a point. But we could... And the main point in this connection is how... and Indra represents Sakam Bhakti. No? Like you are a Bhakta, Indra is a Bhakta, the Devas are Bhaktas, but they are considered Sakam, which means they still have some ulterior motives, some separate desire, they're still delighted in something other than Krishna Bhakti, if you will. And Indra is kind of the, in one sense, personification of being a devotee, but also being having position, having enjoyment, having money, and having all this stuff, which may make it difficult to remain a nice devotee if you are surrounded by too much of that, if you will. So that point is being made through Indra. And of course, kama is a krodha is, you know, from attachment to that enjoyment, if that's frustrated somehow, anger comes. Because anger is basically you have a necessity and it's not satisfied. Someone is angry, it only speaks about you are needy and you have not been able to accomplish your need. And that's, you are showing that through anger, basically. Krishna bhakta nishkama taiva santa bhukti mukti siddhikami sakalyasam. So I will say that the main point of that section is, even if you want to say, okay, Indra saw all this, Indra was aware who Krishna is, yeah, on some level, again, we won't say in the fullest sense, and on that level, okay, he was aware of that, as we may be, I mean, let's not go as far as Indra, let's come here, home. We may say so many times, Krishna is to Bhagavan, so young Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead, but on a daily basis, we may be conduct ourselves as atheist and impersonalist many times. We may act as if God does not exist, as if I am the center, as if everything depends on me. We may be impersonalist in many ways. We may not be fostering our individual sense of responsibility and just trying to be one face merging in the crowd and not having to take the trouble to think for ourselves. That's a form of Mayavad, a form of Sayuja. Merging your face in the crowd and just like, okay, let it be. So my point is, and we are devotees and we know Krishna's two Bhagavan, so yeah, but we also may become distracted of that in relation to that. So Indra, in that sense, is an example of that. Knowing certain things, but become distracted of that because of his attachment to position, and that's what triggers the whole Govardhan Lila. You know, Indra cannot bear, you have cancelled my puja? I mean, how that can possibly happen? I'm trying to imagine. His psychology was like that. No? Yeah, Krishna, God. But he became so mad as he's being like, whatever, downplayed for a minute, that he wanted to kill Krishna, basically, by killing the Vrajavasis. I mean, that was a very, like, dark psychology. You know?
Yeah.
I know how to kill you. I will kill everyone you love, and therefore you will die. So let's kill the Vrajavasis, and Krishna will die as a byproduct of that. So, and he's a devotee again, but he became so much covert, straight to much. These are like also extreme examples to say, you may be a devotee, but be careful. If you are not careful, you may end up doing a very embarrassing thing like Indra did. And it's funny because then, as we know, Indra begs forgiveness and starts to pray. But eventually then when Krishna steals the Parijata flower, he steals again attacking him. Well, so that's making this point. No? Indra is being, if you will, used in that connection. No? Like you can, if you at some point do not transcend your attachment to all this stuff, you may even attack God if that gets in the way of your enjoyment. Because you can have God as part of your life, so he facilitates you whatever you want. And that's a level of making God part of your agenda. But the Bhagavatam is not about making God part of your agenda. Bhagavatam is about becoming part of God's agenda. Krishna has an agenda of his own and he's inviting you, come. But also in the context of making that point, Bhagavatam is contrasting that and giving examples of other devotees, still devotees, who are more of, okay, let's make God part of my agenda. God provide, I need thee, thank you so much. And but if he himself, who is providing what I want, gets in the way of that, I may end up attacking him even. So again, we should learn to identify or find ourselves in all these narrations and get to think, okay, what's being said for me here? In which sense I am Indra? In which sense I am Brahma? In which sense I can relate to this? Even if I'm not doing that potentially. Again, I'm not with fear and shame and guilt, but also being realistic and knowing that as we have a very bright potential, we have also very dark potential if we go in the wrong direction. I mean, we can reach unthinkable layers of of the shallows and going down and down and down and down and down. Or, of course, the idea is, no, you have a bright potential as well, so try to point in that direction. Okay. So I think we are on time, so we can stop here and continue, I think, today in the afternoon, evening.
Yes,
we will be speaking about Gaur Lila, diving into Gaur Lila, and with your permission, we may be mostly focusing ourselves in connection to Ramananda Roy, whose disappearance day is today. So we'll be sharing some Rai Ramananda Katha. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Gonitai ki jai, Grantharashrama Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Brahma Stuti ki jai, Tirupak Mahochakti Ti Ramananda Rai ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand ki jai.